He was a bishop of the Ann Arbor Ward in the Ann Arbor State from 1976 to 1980. Our next presenter is Jody England Hansen, and her paper is entitled Building the Kingdom Without a Permit, What Women Can Do Without the Priesthood. And in her little sort of blip here in the paper, it says, one of six women responsible for turning Eugene England into a feminist. I'll tell you a little bit more about her. She received her Bachelor of Arts from BYU and taught for a couple of years. She's now a freelance, does freelance calligraphy and graphic art, and teaches people how to do their family history. She's married to Michael Hansen and has three children, Charlotte 7, Anna 5, and Joseph 2. And her little note to me was, this paper's for them. And then we'll have comments from Janet Targin, professor of mathematics at Bakersfield College and a Sunstone correspondent. We'll go ahead and turn the time over to them, and hopefully we'll have time for questions after they're finished.
Two unmentioned qualifications are that I have four children, one of whom is here, and two grandchildren, beautiful, 16, 17 months. My major qualification, also for whom this work is dedicated. Thank you for being here. A mother woke up one morning a few years ago to find her child couldn't breathe, was turning blue. In an instantaneous and natural response, she laid her hands on his head and said, "As your mother, I call on the power of the Melchizedek priesthood," and blessed him. He relaxed immediately and began breathing evenly. And when they arrived at the hospital, they were asked why they even bothered to bring him in. I've often imagined what I would do in such a situation and have taken comfort in the fact that I could invoke the priesthood to bless my child. I think it's a blessing every parent and every child deserves, and that we can, as parents and grandparents, identify with the mother and her child, their relief from fear and the joy and well-being that both would have felt. My purpose in this talk is to discuss the favorable consequences of women's ordination of the priesthood. I'll set out the ways in which I think women's ordination will positively influence individual women and men, the church, and in small but ambitious way, the world. Little that I have to say is original with me, and I gratefully acknowledge the work of many contributors to my heart and thoughts concerning this matter, some of whom are here. I would like to preface my remarks with a brief summary of my own personal odyssey on the topic, and in doing so, provide a rationale for my involvement in a subject that many regard as the domain of women and general authorities only. I think that the ordination question is as much a men's problem as it is a women's issue. Men have much to gain from the change, and men are the ones with the power to do something about it. I feel like we are together in this tapestry, and I like being connected with you. Until a year ago, I thought it was God's plan to give men the priesthood so that they could develop the gifts that women came by more naturally. Yeah. 1 year. 1 year. This is a confession. It's okay. Maybe, that's why we're here. Then a friend asked me to contribute an article to the Exponent 2 on matters related to the use of church authority and its abuse. That's when I had a paradigm shift, my conversion experience, the rightness and timeliness of the ordination of women to the priesthood. A year later, after reading the work of many authors on this and related topics and spending many hours of thought concerning it, I felt that my first insight had been confirmed. The study and contemplation that I've done on these matters has only left me with a sense of greater clarity and certainty. I'm at peace regarding the rightness of this change and the positive consequences it will have for the church. I gain more peace on this subject daily, and that is a significant testimony to me concerning the correctness of this idea. Since I consider this inspiration and revelation to me to be personal, I have to have a rationale for sharing it. Two experiences illustrate my motivations. When I was living in Detroit in the 1960s, before the ordination of blacks to the priesthood, we had an African-American brother in the ward who was a Sunday school secretary. He worked on his records while the rest of us went to priesthood meeting. I became uncomfortable walking past him every Sunday morning on the way to my high priest group. I genuinely wanted his full participation as a brother in all aspects of the church, but especially in priesthood meeting. So I determined to write a letter to the church leadership, expressing my feelings and respectfully requesting a change in policy. However, I never wrote the letter. When I told my father about the idea of writing the letter, he said that it would be crazy to do so, since I worked for the church school system at the time. I told this experience to a general authority a couple of years later, and that I wondered if such a letter could have done any good. He said, "It might have." Just like that. Second experience. Bruce McConkie endeared himself to me forever when he spoke at the Salt Lake Institute and made reference to the two Old Testament elders who prophesied in the camp of Israel. Their prophesying caused Joshua to complain to Moses that Moses was the prophet and that others should not be uttering prophecies. Moses replied, "Are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit upon them." Note that Moses didn't say all the Lord's men. He said all the Lord's people. And I felt it was my responsibility to be in tune and to work at both ends of that responsibility. So now I try to repent of my earlier timidity and say what I think and see and know. And today that concerns the availability of God's blessings for all of his children, both daughters and sons. I see shortcomings and even harm in our present policies and great opportunities for improvement in church procedures with the ordination of women. With that personal introduction, I'll move to the main purpose of my talk, to summarize some of the many positive consequences I see coming from the priesthood ordination of women. There are 16 on my list, and you can add more. 1. The first and foremost consequence of women's ordination is to make women equal in the exercise of personal priesthood power, equal in growth opportunities, and equal in access to administrative offices in the church. The scriptures tell us emphatically, all are alike unto God, male and female, equal. God is concerned with fairness, justice, equality. Equality is an irreducible value. And I believe that the most powerful mechanism the church has to make women equal to men is to give them the priesthood. Giving women the priesthood is a structural solution to the problem of inequality in the church. It would work, I think, like the structural solution to racial equality in the American South during the 60s. In Montgomery, Alabama, the city council was debating how many rows on the buses to allocate to the blacks, this during the boycott, because the seating laws were based on the reality of this inferiority. The real solution was not to reallocate the number of seats, but to eliminate the discriminatory seating laws. Then it would be so easy. Anyone could sit wherever there was a seat. I know that changing the priesthood policy wouldn't suddenly solve all of the informal discrimination, insult, and abuse that women sometimes receive, but it would build a bridge over which we could pass to address these problems. Women would immediately have access to all of the spiritual gifts, privileges, blessings, and opportunities for growth that are available in the exercise of the priesthood. The ordination of women would lessen the message of inferiority that we frequently send to women in the church. My own experience, and that of many women, is replete with examples of discrimination and insult. These range from innuendos such as references to the such-and-such program of the priesthood, even though women were also involved in shaping the program, to women being told that they do not know anything or are not as able to perceive and interpret the facts as are the men. A well-educated woman I know and her mother, a woman of national stature, expressed their experience with men in the church in these words, "I'm always wrong because I'm a woman." Men do not appear to listen to the ideas of women as seriously as to those of men at all levels of the church, and this renders women less powerful and promulgates the message of inferiority. I think that the ordination of women would remove a serious challenge to women's self-esteem. I have a friend who is as psychologically healthy an individual as any human being I know, who says when she looks in the mirror, "I don't have the priesthood because God hasn't revealed it. Maybe it's because I'm not worthy. Or can't handle it, in God's opinion. God didn't give me the priesthood. I'm inferior in his eyes." Three, Marion Yates in Women in Authority points out that women often have to masquerade as men in order to have influence and are presently incorporated into the church in a way that they lose themselves as women. Women frequently either hide the energy, intelligence, and other gifts they have, or they must compete in a masculine church. Women need to feel that they are wanted for themselves and for their gifts. The ordination of the priesthood would help in this effort. Of course, this ordination of women would have to be done in a way that would enable women to be fully themselves and not just incorporated into a masculine world. 4. Ordaining women would help to further open up to women the female divinity that's in them. Having the priesthood would affirm women's equality in the creative process, the partnership of the feminine in the divine, and confirm for women their stake in the divine nature by ordaining them to be priestesses as men are ordained priests. Ordaining women would also make men more cognizant of the feminine in the divine. I came to my own sensitivity to the feminine divine after I embraced the idea of women in the priesthood. Shared priesthood seems to send the right conscious and unconscious message that helps both women and men to accept the feminine in the divine and in themselves. 5. Ordination of women would do away with the harmful answers we frequently hear to justify their exclusion. I have a friend who is both faithful and brilliant who found himself stumped by his 6-year-old when she asked why she would not be able to hold the priesthood. He found that every answer but one would send the message of inferiority. His only hope was to say that we don't know why women cannot hold a priesthood. I think that there are two particularly damaging and illogical arguments currently in use. The most egregious, with negative consequences for men as well as women, is the notion that men have the priesthood and women have motherhood. Every time a faithful sister has said this to me, that she doesn't care to have the priesthood because she has motherhood, I have retreated in my argument just a little until I understood that I would say the same thing. I would never choose priesthood over fatherhood. The ordination of women would affirm both fatherhood and motherhood by stopping this comparison that equates parenthood and priesthood, a comparison that makes either parenthood or the priesthood a consolation prize. Another fallacious argument supporting the ordination of men only is that women can pray and that the prayer of faith heals, and therefore women don't need the priesthood. To say this is simply to discount the efficacy of the priesthood. 6. Women's ordination would help men and women communicate more freely. If women were ordained, men wouldn't feel as separated, as it were, from women. They could communicate more freely, naturally. Have you ever noticed how men and women talk differently when the opposite sex is in the room? We would feel more comfortable with each other if we were clearly equal. So, if women were ordained, men and women would have a greater and sweeter sense of partnership. We would bless each other more. It's hard for a woman or a man to ask for a blessing when the implied inferiority and inadequacy is there. I think we would have a lot more blessing in our homes and in our relationships if we were equal in this respect. And this morning, when this point was made in the other room, Marjorie came closer to me and put her hand on my leg. My wife. What if she wasn't here? Wives have not been able to participate freely in giving children a parent's blessing. I am aware that some of you have great courage and knowledge and faith and have moved freely to use what you have known has been your right. But to not make that easily, openly, invitingly available to every woman in the church is not fair and adequate. Okay. I feel that there's been a loss to the mother, and that we have often created a special bond with father-daughter or father-son that could have been more parent-child. I think that with ordination, the feeling of equality would quickly permeate our interactions and would lead to less conflicts and more blessings in the family. if women were ordained, I think that men would feel more congruent with those dimensions of their personalities that are now labeled as feminine. I think that there is an enormous benefit here for men. They can be more fully themselves, accept and increase all positive dimensions of themselves, and be free from the implied and stated superiority that goes with male-only priesthood. Another favorable consequence for men to come from the ordination of women is in the sharing of responsibility for spiritual leadership. Men, at least this man, has felt a great load to carry, the spiritual leadership in the home and the church, because I've had the priesthood. We men get beaten on quite regularly about our responsibilities. I understand that the women also get pretty heavy doses, too. How much nicer it would be to get equal doses as equals. Spiritual leadership is an area we can share and both feel good about. Neither would be usurping. Neither would be dominating. Sharing the priesthood would be the clearest way imaginable to me to communicate that there is shared responsibility for the decision-making, inspiration, answer-knowing, and for leading and managing the home and church. The priesthood, in this sense, would not be something heavy or time-consuming. We would wear it like we wear a smile, and we would all feel lighter and brighter. Ordination would enhance the ability of women to protect young women against discrimination and abuse in the home. In the present structure of the church and family, young women are clearly more vulnerable than young men to abuse and seduction of parents and relatives. The priesthood is potentially a cover against which women are reluctant to take steps. I think that the ordination of women would reduce incidents of sexual abuse in the home. Sharing the priesthood would help to change the power of inequality and the implied inferior status of women, and the priesthood itself would be a force protecting the safety of women and children. A reduction in the inferiority of women could have an effect of enormous proportions among men in the church in their relationships with women. Women's ordination would reduce incidents of sexual abuse that occur occasionally against young women by church officers that range from verbal and voyeuristic acts to overt molesting. With women's ordination, the interview process could readily change so that men interviewed men and women women. I believe that women, and especially young women, should not be expected to go to men with sexual issues. Men might ask themselves how they would like to discuss their sexual problems with their bishop, a woman, or if they would like primary leaders asking their boys if they masturbate. Zion would be a safer place if women had the priesthood. Priesthood for women would provide the access to administrative and organizational leadership responsibility. With their ordination, women could be readily included in church administration at all levels. We'd have the benefit of the other half of the church in bishoprics, stake presidencies, the Quorum of the Twelve, the First Presidency, and the correlation approval process, now managed entirely by committees of men. Just a few months ago, I squirmed when I wrote a woman as a bishop. And a few weeks ago, visited with this lovely friend, person, about 25 years my junior in age, in the hallway, the chapel, and I said, you know, I'd really like you as a bishop. It was so easy to say that. Afterwards, I thought, and she didn't blush. I mean, everyone feels a little humbled by that possibility, but there's no embarrassment. And I asked myself, why did I pick her? Why did I say that? And I answered, because she listens, she likes me, and she respects me. Both can do that. I asked Marjorie, to whom I am married, how she would feel about a woman being president of the church. Because if a woman is an apostle, that's a possibility. I thought she'd shrink a bit, you know. But her answer was delightful. That would be nice. I'm at 12, okay. Giving the priesthood to women on the same basis that it's shared with men would increase the effectiveness of the leadership and administration of the church. I believe that men and women have developed different gifts, at least to some degree. To the extent that there are such differences, we will be better off by including both sets of gifts in our decision-making in the home and the church. I have seen, for example, better decisions regarding sacrament meetings when women were involved in the planning. For the period I was a bishop, I included both men and women on the committee's planning sacrament meetings and believed the inclusion of women enhanced the quality of meetings. For all those years, I looked forward to coming to church every week. Women's involvement in other committees and decisions would have similar positive effects. In fact, I believe that ordaining women would do more to further vitalize the church than anything else we could do. Yeah. It would be like seeing with both eyes instead of one. Gerda Lerner's metaphor. We could see all problems and their solutions with increased depth perception. I believe that the ordination of women would help the young women feel more dignity and feel better about themselves in general. I believe that they need teachings of equality that are convincing to feel right about themselves and the church. I believe that equality in priesthood sharing would help significantly to stem the slide of inactivity among young women in the church and would lead them into greater activity. I think that with the ordination of women, the young women would respond with vigor. The ordination of young women would tend to make life for the youth in the church less heavy, more light and delightful. Both men and women would feel more happiness and would be filled with greater energy. When Marjorie commented on our way from the airport, it was to the effect that if I had the priesthood, that would be fun. I could give blessings. She came to that after spending a couple hours in the airplane reading Women in Authority. We have deep gratitude for the work that many of you have done. There would be less sexism among the youth. The comments I sometimes hear are shocking to me. I think that young men do not respect young women as they would if they were getting the equality message. I think it would make a difference in the attitude of a young man toward a young woman if he sits next to her at the sacrament table. Boys would not feel that they are better than girls. There would be less sexual objectification and less effort at subordination. The ordination of women would provide an appropriate, divinely inspired model for the world, one that recognizes the full status and respect of womanhood. This honoring of women would help both men and women to respond to the need for change in many humiliating, destructive, and debasing cultural practices against women that range from impingements against speech to genital mutilation, murder, and infanticide. The greatest abuses against human life on the earth have been and continue to be in the degradation of the bodies, minds, spirits, and lives of women, and they are perpetrated solely because the victims are female. The millions that are involved are so great that if I use the numbers that I have read, you would question the numbers and stop thinking about the point. We need more education on this matter. The problems are enormous, and how we can avoid doing anything that would move against these monstrous evils is incomprehensible to me. I can only conclude that we do not know, or because the practices are so horrible that we simply cannot let ourselves see them. One of the horrible consequences of making women inferior beings has been for men to learn to make others inferior. I believe that by learning to subjugate women, men have learned to subjugate and dehumanize other groups, and that peace between men and nations will be facilitated by peace, justice, and equality between men and women. This point may seem and may be more than a little grandiose, but the goals of the restored church have always been grandiose. The church can be a powerful influence in the world, far beyond what its numbers indicate, and we cannot minimize the influence for good that is available to us in the church. When the men of the church see great injustice, they are moved to change the situation. I have seen it. I have seen the power of a united minority and have been a part of it. We can make a difference in the world, and we would be more effective if we provided equality for all of God's children. Finally, the ordination of women would enhance all of our relationships with each other and with God as caring, loving, just, and merciful. It would help us all to be more able to find deity in each other, and to nurture and feel the divine within ourselves. The contemplation of this matter has done this for me, and it has been an important step in building my relationship with God. The change will not negatively affect the family or individual's role orientation, which are the all-time reasons given for not making changes in power relationships in the family and in society. I see no downside to women's ordination, and I am thrilled with the eventual possibilities. What we need at this point, I think, is cross-gender discussion, absent rhetoric, on this and all issues of concern, and hopefully conversation with our sustained leaders. Our devotion to the church and to the joy and happiness, growth, and fulfillment of all the members certainly deserves our energy and attention without criticism for our beliefs. Most of us who consecrated ourselves and our talents took our commitment seriously to give fully with our hearts, minds, and spirits. I hope that discussion will go forward in that spirit. I now have the utmost respect and appreciation for what I have read. The dialogue is just the beginning, but without it there would be no beginning. It's going to take some time, I think, and it will come faster the more we talk about it. Now, to conclude, my purpose here was to discuss some of the many positive consequences to the ordination of women in the LDS Church. As I did my examination, I was impressed that not only are the consequences for women utterly compelling, there are important and wonderful consequences for men, for children, for the church, and even for the larger community in which we live. As a group, these consequences make a powerful and compelling reason why women should have the priesthood in full participation. This is my vision as I see, feel, and know it. I do not come with directions for anyone. This is what I know. Take anything you think is good and leave the rest. Thank you for being here and for letting me be a part of the dialogue.
Father Eugene England told me that when writing a paper, a good title has two parts. And once you have the title, the paper will write itself. One of the things I love about my father is the fact that he is not always right. It makes me feel comfortable around him. The paper did not write itself, and the two-part title I chose led some people to think this paper was against women having the priesthood. So I need to add a third part to the title. It is now Building the Kingdom of God Without a Permit, What Women Can Do Without the Priesthood, Looking Forward to When We Have It. My husband Michael and I moved to Layton a little over 6 years ago. We had found a 100-year-old Victorian farmhouse that had been remodeled several times during the past 50 years. The ornate brickwork had been painted over in white, stained glass windows had been covered over and nailed through. The ceilings had been lowered 2 feet, and the tops of the tall sash windows had been covered up. The doors and molding had been painted over so many times, the detail work could not be seen. It looked to us as if someone had tried to take this fine Victorian lady and turn it into a tract home. When we were first looking at it, we knew that under the ugly cover-up, there was a beautiful home that needed someone to discover it again, and we were insane enough to take on the project. We started the day we moved in. And we are still working on it. With the help of Alan Roberts and his architectural skills, we were able to make the right decisions as we restored some parts and remodeled others. We did most of the work ourselves, and it has been a tremendous educational experience for us. We aren't aware, and weren't aware, of which football and basketball teams were headed for the playoffs. We never saw newly released movies at the theaters, and we didn't know what new shows were on TV, but we always knew what the current project was on This Old House and Home Time. At 9 a.m. every Saturday morning, we knew we would take a break from rewiring or sheetrocking or whatever to be reassured by Norm Abrams on the new Yankee Workshop that we could send for a measured drawing of the day's project, and we too could accomplish what he had done in the last half hour. Our three children, we've yet to accomplish those things. Our three children, two of whom were born since moving to this house, played with wood and sheetrock scraps as much as they played with their Legos. They wanted to paint with latex primer as much as with their watercolors, and they could climb ladders before they climbed jungle gyms at the playground. They never knew if the room they slept in 1 week would be emptied and gutted the next, or if they would have a home-cooked meal or takeout. But they knew they could count on seeing Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, and now Barney every day. Every night they knew we would sing songs, the two favorites being I'm a Child of God and Cannibal King. Read stories. And as far as they're concerned, they go together. Read stories, say prayers, and kiss each other goodnight. At times we felt that with every two steps forward, we were pushed back more than one. We had just finished sheetrocking and painting the main floor and moved everything downstairs while we gutted the second floor. I hired two men to tear out the old chimney upstairs while I was working in the backyard. They knocked it down with sledgehammers, letting the soot that filled it pour down the stairwell and cover most of the main floor and everything on it, including my three-year-old daughter who was taking a nap on the couch. When I came in, I found the inside of my house had turned a dull shade of gray. Michael was out of town on a business trip. I came very close to packing up a few clothes, my favorite books, and my complete set of dialogues, and putting a for sale as is sign out in front and leaving the house never to return. But I didn't. Michael's cousin Christine, and that is a name that I feel is very appropriate for her, came over and spent the evening and most of the night helping me clean the worst of the mess out of the main floor. Anyone who has cleaned up soot can appreciate what a truly Christian act this was. Throughout the night, while we worked together, she knew when to listen and when to speak, and she carefully guided me from being on the verge of hysteria back to having a certain degree of common sense and the hope that I could deal with this setback. This is one of the many reasons that I count her as one of my spirit sisters. We have completed most of the work on the house, and once again, it is a beautiful Victorian home. We have planted 38 trees and huge perennial gardens on what was a weed lot surrounding the house. We have learned a lot about what it means to be stewards of the earth and have some empathy with the charge given to Adam and Eve over the garden to keep it glorious and beautiful. We are avid organic gardeners. Our neighbors maintain golf course lawns with the help of Chemlawn, shake their heads in bewilderment as we put in drought-hardy ground cover in place of grass. We go around the neighborhood in the fall collecting their bags of leaves to put in our compost bin. But this is the first year some of them have begun to ask us why things seem to grow so much better in our yard, and why we attract so many birds and butterflies. A few neighbors have begun to borrow our issues of organic gardening, while others still view it as subversive literature. There is no way to adequately describe the joy I feel when thousands of bulbs that I've planted cover our yard with many colors throughout the spring. This never fails to reinforce my belief in how the atonement of Christ brings us new life, and I enjoy celebrating Easter in the midst of the flowers. We are glad for our part of the world we are helping recreate. We recognize this is a project that will continue in different ways for as long as we live in the house, and working on this project together has created a great bond between Michael and I that I don't believe an average suburban life could. And I believe it is because we worked on every part of it together. Our most ambitious phase of remodeling involved removing and rebuilding half of the second floor and changing portions of the other half. We had obtained a building permit and progressed to the point when the city inspector could make his first visit. We were redoing the three existing bedrooms, rewiring, adding insulation, shelves, sheetrock, and most importantly, windows that opened. We knew that the fixed pieces of plexiglass that were there would be inadequate, even dangerous, for an upstairs bedroom. We installed the largest sash windows that would fit in the dormers, which we also enlarged so they would match the proportions and style of the house. This was the only problem we ran into with the inspector. Local code required bedrooms to have a window large enough for a firefighter to climb through with his equipment pack on. In our case, the entire opening was plenty large, but the lower sash opening was not, and that was the part that mattered to the inspector. I asked if the firefighter would hesitate to break the window in order to get through, and he said no, but code required the larger opening so the city could avoid being sued by a homeowner over a broken window. We could have put in a window that was large enough if we changed the roof line or tore out some of the original brick. Either way, it would have destroyed the look of the home. We offered to sign a release promising the city we would not sue if the firefighter had to break the window to save our children, but of course that wasn't acceptable. So we stood there with the blueprints and inspection form between us, feeling frustrated that after all this work, we would have to destroy the look of the house we were trying so hard to restore. I asked the inspector if he could think of any other options, and I think he had begun to appreciate what we were trying to do because he said, "All I can tell you is that as long as these blueprints label these areas as being bedrooms, I cannot pass this inspection." Michael and I looked at each other. I picked up a carpenter's pencil, crossed out the words, bedroom number one, bedroom number two, bedroom number three, and wrote in their place, den, studio, library. The inspector signed the form, and we were able to continue with a valid building permit. I see many similarities between my experience working on this house and my experience as a member of the church. Members of the church in my family go back many generations, well over 100 years. It has been part of my life since my earliest memories. My parents taught or spoke of how my belief and membership in the church would affect every aspect of my life, and that has become the case. Until I became a young adult, the church was like a Victorian mansion to me, beautifully designed and well-built, so it gave a feeling of security. With fine craftsmanship and a variety of details, so it would always be interesting. Large rooms with unique angles that had room for everyone who wanted to come in. Tall windows that let in plenty of light, surrounded by large trees that offered cool, comforting shade in times of distress or sorrow. Fruit for sustenance in times of need, and many colorful plants and flowers to encourage variety and provide pleasure and enjoyment. But I started having experiences with people who didn't think the church should be that way. Some who felt uncomfortable with a church that was large and spacious and welcoming to everyone were like people who didn't like large rooms with tall ceilings because they were difficult to keep clean and heated. Some who seemed uncomfortable with having open forums for discussion, dialogue, and a variety of ideas were like those who didn't want large windows because they let in too much light, let too much heat escape, and old furniture and rugs, like old traditions, were in danger of fading from all that light. And they didn't like the idea of people outside being able to see inside. People who felt uncomfortable with the growing diversity in the church, or who felt good literature, education, politics, and entertainment was that approved by a small segment of society, were like those who didn't like trees or plant beds because they were difficult to mow around and the leaves had to be raked and bagged. They like lawns because if you feed them enough fertilizer, they will stay one solid color. And you can mow them to keep all the blades at the same height, and if a weed should dare to poke its head up, you can dump selective poison on it to kill it without killing the grass. Seems like a safe and easy way to maintain a yard, but too much fertilizer keeps the roots from going deep and makes the soil hard, and the selective poison hangs around, contaminates the water and other plants, and eventually hurts the landowner. I was seeing my mansion being changed into a tract home because others thought it should be that way. But I was learning more about my own ability, and there were still plenty of connections between the church and what was always wonderful to me, my belief in Christ and in his example. And no one else could change the strength and beauty of that. I didn't know from one week to the next if I would have the same teacher or bishop at church because they were changed without notice. I didn't know when wards would be divided or combined, but I did know there would be a place to go every Sunday. And whether I enjoyed the teachers and speakers or not, there was always a chorus, many different people singing hymns together, a prayer to welcome God and a prayer to send us home safely, to have peace of the sacrament. I always find that those beautiful words repeated each time remind me of how the atonement of Christ makes true life possible, and I am comforted and reassured. I served in a variety of callings as I grew older, most of them being in the capacity of teacher. I think teaching is a wonderful calling. I felt the freedom of using the manual as a guide and then applying real experiences of the class members to the subject. I loved all the scriptures offered to me and how they led me to enjoy other great literature even more. I found that every aspect of my life offered resources for teaching, and my only limit seemed to be time. Then I was called to be a Relief Society president in a single student ward, and I gained a whole new understanding of what it means to serve in the church. I had to report things to different people, go through channels to get anything done, be aware of how ward members were doing during the week as well as on Sunday. I found myself asking people to do things they didn't feel like doing, even if they had already promised to. But the hardest thing for me was knowing about problems that I felt I couldn't do anything about. A Relief Society sister wanted to repent of some serious sins, but she felt she could not confess to the bishop. She could not bring herself to believe a man could understand her problems. Why wasn't there a woman she could speak with? Another sister became seriously ill in the middle of the night, and she did not want to call her home teachers, whom she did not feel especially comfortable with, to come over and give her a healing blessing. She went through the night alone, not wanting to bother her roommates, but she later asked me if there would have been something wrong about asking her roommates to pray with her and ask in faith for her to be comforted and healed. Another sister who was engaged openly expressed her excitement to be married because then she would no longer be responsible for her decisions. What she did with the rest of her life, good or bad, would be the credit or fault of her husband. She believed that supporting the priesthood meant she give her agency to him, and she looked forward to it. I struggled with leadership training meetings where I was told to make sure everyone was fulfilling their callings, attending their meetings, having their needs met, but I was told not to counsel or advise and not to interpret doctrine. I was meeting people's needs according to the bishop's recommendations. Now, my bishop at the time tended to listen to my feelings about a situation before his recommendation, and I know that was not always the case in other wards. But I realized as time went on that I was trying to help people in a situation where I was giving little information. I had reason to believe the ward counselors and clerks knew more about the sisters in my Relief Society than I did, and I began to wonder how effective I could be in my calling in building the kingdom of God without having the rights of the priesthood, without an official permit to build. I had learned to have confidence in my individual ability to learn, to grow in spiritual strength, to serve others, and to be worthy. These are crucial characteristics to have in building the kingdom, and I had learned I was the only one who could develop and use them as my own. I had made a covenant to do so, and no one else could or should do it for me. Any woman in the church who has dated more than a few returned missionaries is aware that holding the priesthood is not necessarily a sign of worthiness, even though the stated requirements are high. The men who hold the priesthood are at all levels of worthiness. Section 121 gives an accurate description of what happens when someone views holding the priesthood as an unconditional power instead of a responsibility with strict guidelines. That person has no priesthood. I remember the jolting realization of this when a young man I was dating told me that I could only progress as far as the man I married chose to let me. And even if I did become worthy of the celestial kingdom, I wouldn't be able to get in unless he called my name. I never worried that this might be true in the eternities, but I wondered how much it might be true during my earth life. Would I always need to wait for a priesthood holder to give me permission before I could continue beyond a certain point, regardless of my own worthiness and ability? Would I have to get so caught up in red tape of building codes to obtain a permit when I couldn't follow that I couldn't follow my own conscience telling me to maintain the integrity of my house? Many experiences have empowered me and taught me ways I can effectively continue to build the kingdom without that official permit of the priesthood, or ways that I can technically follow the rules to get needed permission from priesthood leaders, but I'm really just crossing out some words on the blueprints and writing in other ones. I believe in the qualities the priesthood is supposed to represent, and I believe all of us can develop and teach each other these qualities. After Mike and I were married, we were in young family wards with bishops who felt a responsibility in helping us learn to build Zion. I saw the real benefits of men and women working together in many ways to build the kingdom. First, in my father's ward, he wanted the young couples to serve together. Most callings were held by couples, and visiting and home teaching was done by them. He would rotate the callings every 6 months, so we would be trained in many ways. The next ward was led by Bishop Dylan Annoy and his wife Jeannie. And again, couples served together, and callings were changed frequently. It was divided into districts, each led by a couple, and we were able to take part in study groups and take turns developing lessons for them. I found myself gaining confidence in my ability to seek and receive guidance. I served as Relief Society president again. I felt my thoughts and opinions were sought after and valued, and I appreciated the patience shown to all of us by Bishop Inouye. I learned a great deal about humility from him, and he would not hesitate to apologize when he felt he had done something that had detracted from the spirit of a meeting, or in any way hindered what he was trying to teach us. He truly understood the importance of eliminating and consolidating meetings so we could have more time with our families. Jeannie Annoy is still an example to me. She had an amazing career in law, consciously chose to take time to be a full-time mother, but continued to develop her own skills and use her abilities whenever possible. She helped me feel appreciated for my own unique abilities without feeling like I had to be like anyone else. Our years in that ward challenged us, strengthened us, and prepared us. The ward we moved to in Layton was very different. I did not feel accepted at first. I was arrogant enough to believe I had more to offer than anyone else and that my skills were unappreciated. I gradually developed friendships with some people, and I was surprised that I could feel close to people with such vastly different backgrounds from my own, but I felt lonely and out of place. Then after a few years, I was called to be Relief Society president, and again, God was teaching me a lesson. There was an audible gasp from the congregation when I was sustained in sacrament meeting. I felt most of the sisters did not want me there, and I often felt hurt and discouraged by remarks and feedback I received. I had never worked so hard at something where I felt I was making no headway. I wanted to quit. pull out of active service in the ward and use it in other areas where it would be more rewarding and fulfilling. And then a dear friend, Cindy, came to visit. She was also struggling as a Relief Society president in difficult circumstances. I don't think there are favorable circumstances for that calling. We shared our frustrations with each other, but I think she listened more than she spoke. And after a while, she said, "Jody, there are times when I wonder if remaining active in the church is worth it, even though I don't doubt my testimony. But I believe wonderful things will be happening in the church. Great changes are coming, and I would rather be an active part of those changes than an outside observer of them." She is another sister in spirit, and she gave me hope. So did a dream I had at about that time. This was actually more than a dream to me because I remember the details so vividly. Michael and I were sitting together in sacrament meeting, and our children were all older than toddler age. I know this because we were sitting quietly. Our bishop was at the pulpit and said he had just received a bulletin from the First Presidency to read. It was a revelation changing the nature of priesthood administration and extending ordination to women. I remember Michael embracing me as I wept for joy. And when I awoke, I was still weeping. With the hope and belief I gained from this, I could go on with my calling. So I do believe that day is coming, but I don't believe I should sit around and wait for it. This is a very condensed list of what I've learned women can do without the priesthood, believing it will come. We can hope for the revelation by preparing for it. In the 60s, I remember my parents responding to counsel given by a prophet at conference by praying for the day when the priesthood would be extended to all races. It became a topic of articles and arguments, lessons and firesides. Dad was denounced as a heretic by some members of the church because he believed blacks should and would have the priesthood. And his job as a faculty member at Stanford was threatened because he was active in a church that denied blacks the priesthood. By the time the 70s came, I believed a revelation would come. It was just a matter of time. And June 1978 was truly a time of rejoicing. I don't believe that revelation would have come without the prayers, the discussions, people changing their hearts on the subject and preparing themselves. I know the revelation did not hinge on the worthiness of the black race because they had never been unworthy. We as a church had to be able to accept it, which meant enough members had to come to expect, want, and ask for the revelation. That is what must happen now concerning women in the priesthood. We can write and discuss and teach and question and pray. And I am seeing some real strides being made. Thank you, Carolyn, for Mother Wolf of the Morning. A few years ago, I was the only one in my ward who said the words Mother in Heaven out loud. A few months ago, on Mother's Day, several women participated openly in a discussion I led about our Heavenly Mother, sharing very tender experiences, and another mentioned her in her prayer. Last week in Michael's Elders Quorum, a man was giving a lesson entitled Presiding in the Home. He began by asking if they agreed with him that women were as worthy as men, and they all agreed. And then he asked why any man should presume to preside over a woman. He led a discussion on recognizing different ways women can and should share in the priesthood. These are great events in a conservative ward, and to me it shows people are preparing for a change. We can heal others, and we can help men learn how to heal. Years ago, when my first child, Charlotte, was a month old, I got a breast infection which turned into a severe case of toxic shock syndrome. In a matter of hours, I became dangerously ill. Michael was trying to take care of our one-month-old baby all night while I tried to make it through what I thought was the worst case of the flu I'd ever had. By morning, I asked Michael to call my parents so he and Dad could give me a blessing and Mom could come and help. They came right over. Dad and Michael gave the blessing and then went in the other room to visit, and Mom stayed with me to do the healing. She tried to get liquids in me, put cold cloths on my head. She practically carried me into the bathroom and worried about my fever and talked me through my delirium. And when I didn't think I could stand any more of the pain, I looked at her and said, matter-of-factly, "I think I want to die now." The mother replied kindly but firmly, "No, you don't want to die. You have a new baby in the other room that needs you to live. You are not going to die. She helped me want to hang on to life until they got me to the hospital. This has usually been my experience with healing. Men heal by giving a blessing. Women heal by tending, listening, feeding, and encouraging. Each part is important, but both men and women should be able to participate in all of it. Since then, I have received blessings from women. I have given blessings, and I have seen Michael learn the other aspects of healing. Our second child, Anna, had to go to the hospital with pneumonia when she was 3. I was with her during the day while Mike was at work. He stayed with her at night while I went home to sleep. He was the only father I saw staying at the hospital with a child. He held her, read to her, and sang to her, blessed her, and comforted her during the treatments they gave her. This was especially difficult the first night when she was at high risk and terrified of all the treatments they were giving to get oxygen into her. But Michael never left her. We can learn from each other. We can try to know God, our heavenly parents. They are our greatest example of eternal priesthood holders. I have known about and believed in my heavenly mother since I was a young child, but I tried for many years to find out where she was. I don't believe it is a coincidence that so many people are having experiences with our mother in heaven or a greater awareness of her. I believe that in order for the kingdom of God to grow, women must have a real example of what their divine potential is, and that we can have contact with her. We have waited long enough for that, and many of us can wait no longer, and we are asking, even crying out for her. Years ago, I found her, not hidden or hiding or protected, but in the place where I had always found the most comfort, next to my Heavenly Father. My most vivid experience with her occurred just after I was called to be Relief Society president for the third time. I felt there were people who wanted me to fail, and I became so overcome with fear and concern I could hardly function. I was lying in bed one night, terrified of what would come with the next day, and I couldn't even bring myself to pray, and I asked Michael to give me a blessing. As he blessed me, he said that Mother and Father in Heaven were concerned about me and the sisters in the ward. They gave me assurance that others could not make me fail. They loved me and wanted me to succeed. I sensed the presence of Mother and Father in Heaven on either side of me, and they were both holding me, as parents would cradle a frightened child. She was stroking my head and comforting me, and whenever I think or speak of God, it is the two of them. I know that we as women will not be limited in the eternities, and it is time for us not to feel limited here. Knowing our heavenly parents empowers us for good work. We can appreciate all the diversity in the church. During my time as Relief Society president in the ward, I worked with and developed friendships with women who I thought would never accept me and that I would never be able to care for, but they have accepted me and helped me in patience. I've learned about their faith and devotion, the unique challenges they have had to deal with, and their capacity for Christ-like service. Yes, some of them are people who don't like trees or tall ceilings, and they spray their lawns with chemicals and think dialogue is for heretics. But I feel their love for me and a tiny willingness from them to see the possibility that a faithful member might be able to attend Sunstone. I cannot expect others to accept me as a unique individual if I cannot appreciate them in the same way. If others know my faith is greater than the bands of death, it will make the changes I suggest is possible in the church less frightening to them. I know what we do with our lives can be of great value to many others as well as ourselves. I love Sister Okazaki's talk last conference in which she compared our lives to threads which intertwine and weave to create a beautiful pattern. I could not possibly know in advance all the different threads that would create patterns with mine or which ones will in the future. I cannot completely control that, but I have found there is much I can do to strengthen and control my own thread. I believe this will help create a more beautiful pattern. Ultimately, that is what all of us can do. The first major decision we have record of making was choosing the uncertainty of agency over the simplicity of being controlled. Our very presence here on Earth shows that we are ultimately pro-agency. We need to recognize the great power and potential that is inherent in that agency. Not even the rights of priesthood administration can overwhelm that. I do believe a revelation will come changing women's role in the priesthood. But that revelation will not suddenly make us all powerful or good or Christ-like or capable of healing. it will give us the responsibility, the opportunity to use these qualities more readily. We can develop and use these qualities as much as possible now. We can prepare to administer with them worthily, so when changes come, the building process will not be interrupted. I'm excited to be living in a time when great changes are occurring. It says something about many people who live at this time to help bring about change for good. I feel the joy that comes with the new life of spring when I see women and men discover more about women's divine worth, or realize sharing the priesthood is a good idea, or have personal experiences with Heavenly Mother. Women of this day have a great responsibility to demonstrate that worth. Sister Okazaki said in a talk to the pilgrimage, "I may be the first, but I'm going to make sure I'm not the last." I hope we can accept the unique challenges of building the kingdom at this time the way our greatest example would, with strength and confidence, with humility and a desire to heal, and with Christ-like love.
Well, I've got a lot of thoughts, as usual, about this topic, and I'll share some of those with you. I also have two children, by the way. I have a 12-year-old daughter, Kristen, who's at Young Women's Camp right now, and a 7-year-old daughter, Erin, who's at my cousin's house, and he just arrived, so I hope she's doing okay today. I want to share a few experiences I've had during the past few years, but mostly in this past year, that have made me think more about this topic, and they relate in some ways to the experiences they've had. Then I'll respond to each of the papers quickly, and hopefully leave quite a bit of time for you, because I know that's always something that we want more of in Sunstone. In the 1970s, I read out of Dialogue the article that Linda Newell did, and it was referred to this morning again in one of the sessions. At the time, though, I was a teenager. I think we're probably close to same age and experiences with BYU and things like that. I was a Kimball Scholar at BYU.
We were all three about it.
I skipped you, Scott, sorry. As a Kimball Scholar at BYU, I felt very valued by my church experience. I felt encouraged by Sister Kimball as she gave our welcoming speech for the group that arrived in 1977. It was an exciting time to be a woman. We were told to be all that we could be. It was fantastic. So I never felt the burning issues of, gee, I don't have the priesthood. This is a terrible thing in my life. And I think that helps to explain the two of us. And then Scott's late arrival. About a year ago, I was asked to respond to a talk at Sunstone. The talk was why I don't want my daughters to have the priesthood. And that was the first time that I really had to face the issue in a tough and serious way. Before that, I did have one experience when my 12-year-old daughter was 8 and had just been baptized here in Salt Lake City, and we went home to Bakersfield. The Sunday after we got home, she was just sitting there, you know, beaming with the excitement of her recent baptism. And on the same Sunday, there was a cute little 12-year-old boy just beaming with his excitement at being ordained to the priesthood. And it hit me like a ton of bricks for the first time in my life that my darling, angelic little 8-year-old, precious little child would not have that experience because she was a female. And I watched him and I watched his family, the entire row, you know, just proud as can be. You'll notice that on Sundays when the deacons get to pass the bread for the first time. It was an incredible experience for me then. But again, I left it aside. I was busy with teaching and children and all the other things. So until last year, I didn't have to face it in a serious way. Last year, I thought I would go first to my major advisors. By the way, my husband's back there, John, if you want to be noticed too. I went to my daughters and asked them last year, do you want to have the priesthood? Would you like it? I can't remember how I said it exactly, and they, without hesitation, said, oh, yes. Of course, they were what, 6 and 11 at the time. And I said, why? And they said, to bless babies and sick people and to baptize people and, oh, I'd love to pass the sacrament and the bread and water, and neither one mentioned power or authority or running the whole show or anything negative. They simply thought that would be a neat thing to do. They saw the priest as being something positive and uplifting that would bring them closer to God. And these are things that adult women bring up too, that bring us closer to God and help us participate in decision making. Anyway, so my daughters have helped me view the issue better. Last night, my 7-year-old, who's almost 8, said, "Mommy, I want you to baptize me." Now, I never had that from my older daughter. And that was an interesting thing to hear. And I said, "Oh, gee, life's tough, isn't it?" I don't remember what I said. It was brilliant. But I put my arm around her and said, "That's interesting. Maybe you'll be able to do it when your children are big." A couple of different thoughts here. Oh, she, the 7-year-old, and her friend, who's 8-year-old, they played soccer together. They played basketball. They played baseball. Co-ed teams on some of them, but not soccer. Anyway, they're just really a dynamic pair, energetic, capable, strong kids. They're sitting, but she comes to church with us a lot. And we're sitting on the back pew because I like to watch people. And they were sitting very quietly visiting with each other. And it was a Sunday where a child was being confirmed, and it was one of their class members because they are 7 and 8-year-olds this year. And so they both looked up at the front, and this friend who's not LDS looked up at the front, and she stopped talking to my daughter Erin. She looked at the front, and her jaw dropped, and she watched as one person after another came up from the audience. And then she looked at me and said, "How come they're all men?" And it was interesting. I said, "You know what, Sarah? I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you. Maybe when you're a grown-up, there won't be. But right now, that's just kind of the way it is. And I don't know why." I think that is the best answer. And both speakers today seem to agree with that, that that's the only one we've got right now, is we don't know why, and we hope for the future. I think we all see gifts of the Spirit as being non-gendered. They mentioned that this morning. The church, I believe that the church policy of priesthood only for males cuts women off from the church flow of ideas and the flow of information. And it does that because women have to depend on men in order to get access to information through priesthood meetings. Women are capable, thinking, feeling, insightful, powerful, funny, kind, warm, interesting, and capable human beings. I probably already said that because I think we are. And I think it would improve the church if we were able to be a full participants with that. More there, but I think I'll be mentioning it later. I already mentioned it was a year ago that I had my first major struggle with the issue, like Scott. And any of you that attended this morning's session realize that this afternoon's topic is probably like the kindergarten topic compared to the issues that they were dealing with this morning, I think. But today, as we're talking about priesthood, we're talking about church-recognized authority type priesthood and freedom to be full participants in that. And I think that's pretty obvious, but I wanted to point it out. I have got some comments for Scott's paper, and I've tried to, rather than hit the 16 points, I've tried to hit a few of them in order to leave more time. I thought that the message to make women equal is an extremely important one, and in a way I'm troubled by the statement to make women equal, because that implies that we're not. And I might be a little sensitive there, but I think we need to recognize that equality. God has mentioned it in Scripture, and that we ought to then allow women opportunities for power, for growth, for access to administrative offices. And in doing so, allow men the opportunity to see women as role models. I think that's useful for both women, young women, to see women as role models and to get that kind of experience. But it's useful for men to see women as role models. I think too often our young men not only don't respect the young women that they interact with as much as they could, but they don't expect adult females as much as they could, for whatever reasons. Lessen the message of inferiority, I think, is extremely important. One of my favorite insights was when I was playing in a regional playoff volleyball game, and men came pouring out of a priesthood meeting. I'm sorry. I'm assuming it was something to do with priesthood. Men came pouring out of a meeting at the church building, and it was only men in the meeting. I just assumed. And they walked right across the middle of our court. And this is in Salt Lake City, where women play sports more than in other states sometimes. But they walked right across, right in the middle of the thing, and that just amazed me, that they wouldn't be sensitive to the fact that we were playing in a high-level competitive match, and they should have gotten off our court. I asked them to leave quite quickly, and they did. But it was interesting to me. in lessening the message of inferiority, he mentioned this several times in different ways throughout the paper. One of the other ones was to do away with harmful answers. The parenthood priesthood is an extremely important one, because I think we don't want to send the message to girls at age 10 and 11 that when the boys get the priesthood at age 12, the girls should then be accessing motherhood. I don't think that's something that we want to open up. And have access to, so that isn't good enough either. The third dangerous or harmful answer that I think Scott missed out on is probably because he didn't miss it. He said it in a different place. The idea that women aren't good enough is something, and that's part of the inferiority message and everything else, but it's one of those harmful answers of why don't women have the priesthood. Well, it could be because there are other reasons for it, but one of those real strong ones is because we're just plain old not good enough. It's the same excuse we heard for blacks not getting the priesthood. And there were a lot more discussions, if I remember correctly, in Sunday school lessons and things like that about the color of skin being something that implied earlier problems in, you know, your ancestors' choices and actions and things like that. And so there is still that heavy-duty message that if you don't have the priesthood, there's something wrong with this whole class of people. And I think it would be nice to get rid of that, just like we've gotten rid of the color of skin being an issue in our Sunday school discussions. And that's been a nice change over the last 15 years. The partnerships and friendships, men with women, I think this is beautiful, the idea that we would be able to communicate more freely, that we'd participate together in decision-making. Anyway, I loved it. I appreciated Scott's perspective as a bishop, his bringing his experiences as a bishop to the paper, and also hoping for and looking forward to a happier church experience. I'll try to move on because I'm taking longer than I should. and you don't need to hear this. I'm not as hopeful that the changes would come too quickly. One of the things involved in a lot this past year, partially due to my experience with the talk a year ago, is just the plain old gender issues, period. I've got to participate in a four-day workshop with a colleague, or with other colleagues from my college, on gender team building. We went in gender pairs to Phoenix, and we were there for 4 days, and we did nothing but talk about gender issues, and it was fantastic. But there are quite a few gender studies out there that show that it's not just a church problem. Men tend to interrupt women more often than women interrupt men when there's discussions going on. Boys get more, the AUW report shows that boys get more attention in schools, and we have a huge societal problem with boys being valued more than girls and receiving that message throughout life. I think that the priesthood is something that if we given to women, it would be a nice start, but it's a small start compared to what work needs to be done in consciousness raising. One of the interesting ones is men think that when problems are brought to them, they need to provide answers and solve problems. This is the generalization that I hate doing, but I'm going to. Whereas women are more likely to recognize that someone just needs to unload, and they're willing to listen. And for that, I think in church leadership, it might be very nice to have women leaders who are willing to just listen to the problems that are brought, rather than having to think of solutions for you while you're talking. The idea of the gender team building, the reason I mention it was that we were encouraged to recognize differences. And none of us here have said that there are not differences between men and women. But we're encouraged to recognize differences and then move on. Build on the differences, work as teams, build together toward a brighter future. So, Scott, I'm going to leave you alone for a minute. I really appreciated the paper. Move on to Jody's paper. Again, I already pointed out, I think as I read her paper before I had met her, I thought, I bet we're about the same age because of the kinds of things like a father who was very busy during the 60s arguing and talking about blacks should have the priesthood or at least being involved in the home discussing that. My dad took a black friend who's a professional to priesthood meeting with him, and a Mexican friend who was a pharmacist to priesthood meeting one day to Elders Quorum, and he had them wear bags over their head and garden gloves. And then suits. And the priesthood lesson, he just brought these friends to visit, and he had people ask them questions. Boy, by the end of a half hour, 45 minutes of interviewing these two people that were obviously professionals, well-versed in their fields, and extremely capable, bright, wonderful people to have in brotherhood with them, at the end of the lesson, my dad pulled off the sacks and the garden gloves. And for a very white, conservative town, Manhattan Beach, California, it was I think probably a really neat lesson. I was a little kid, so I only got to hear my dad's perspective. I didn't hear everyone else's. But As I read Jody's paper, I was impressed at our experience, or the similarities in our ages, our children's ages, and things like that. But then I noticed some differences in our experiences, and part of that I think is due to now at that time my dad was attending church during much of my childhood. My parents were inactive, and so I missed out on some of that church. Not identity so much, because when you're fifth generation Mormon, boy, you grow up knowing all the stories, all the heritage, all the pride, everything. It doesn't matter if you're there on Sunday or not. And anyway, so there's I didn't miss out on that identity, but I did miss out on some of the feeling of righteousness or something like that when I got together with my BYU roommates and things, when there's a comparison of, you know, what you did during primary years, kinds of stuff. What I'm thinking is some of my BYU roommates and some of my cousins whose dads were regional representatives and who were well connected with church leadership positions, some of those people felt more willing to take the blueprints and cross out bedrooms and write in den and library and study than I felt. And so I'm very appreciative of Jody's willingness to share that perspective and to share that. It almost feels like advice to me. Because I saw that in some of my female friends, and yet I didn't feel that kind of freedom. And I still don't feel that kind of freedom as an individual to just say, oh, I know that's what we're being told, but if we just change it in this way, I'll be able to go on and do what I want to do anyway. And I'm stretching a little farther than you probably intended it, but I recognized that in the paper. I thought, wow, I remember some of my BYU roommates feeling very comfortable with changing the blueprints, and I didn't. In our experience as a teacher, I'm also amazed at four times Relief Society president? Three times. Okay. Oh, and then you referred back. Okay. I'm amazed. I haven't been Relief Society president. I haven't been any president yet, but I've done a lot of teaching, and I have similar experiences in the kinds of teaching experiences. But I also appreciated the point of view of the Relief Society president who, even as Relief Society president, didn't feel that she had all the information that could have been helpful to her to address needs. And I think how much less connected those of us that are not Relief Society presidents have felt throughout our adult lives when we're not in presidencies and we're never in those meetings with people. How much less information we have as we're trying to address needs of our colleagues. I thoroughly appreciated the sharing of the dream and the priesthood ordination. I think that's important to share personal experiences, and I was glad for that. And oh, the other one is the sharing of the importance of the mother in heaven. A year ago, I was with a group of women, and there was a chance for a testimony sharing kind of experience. And that was the first time I'd been around so many women who had such deep feelings for their mother in heaven and who had accessed her for strength and for comfort throughout their lives. And it was fascinating to me because it hadn't been an important part of who I had been growing up. And so because I'm so good at following those rules, and I read Sonia Johnson's From Housewife to Heretic, and she got in big trouble for big trouble for praying to her mother in heaven. I'm really pleased to see that people are willing to keep that discussion alive, and especially after a year ago, seeing all those women and the importance it was in their lives, I want other women to have access to that, and my daughters. I agree that we need to prepare for the change through prayer, through writing, through discussing, through teaching. That we need to appreciate diversity, accept others, and I appreciate the perspectives there. You can tell we're getting close. A year ago, I ended with something that I felt very strong about, and I'd like to take a couple minutes to give you the same ending. It's a little short paragraph out of a Science News essay, and it's about the education of girls, and I feel very strongly about this paragraph saying it all. It talks about the rate of return in educating girls, and I would include allowing women the priesthood in the same thing. There are those who say educating girls is a strategy that pays off only in the long run. This argument reminds me of a story which John F. Kennedy used to tell, of a man asking his gardener how long it would take for a certain seed to grow into a tree. The gardener said it would take 100 years, to which the man replied, "Then plant the seed this morning. There is no time to lose." And I think that Scott and Jody have done an excellent job of pointing out the benefits to having women have the priesthood and being ordained and being full participants. I was amused a little bit yesterday. I hesitate to share this because it sounds more negative than it is, but yesterday Leonard Arrington was asked what the most positive aspect of his 10 years as church historian was. What was his best memory of those 10 years? And he, without hesitation, said it was the 1978 revelation when all worthy members were given the priesthood. And I can't tell you what that felt like in the back row. I like the back row every time I sit in a room. I don't think many people in the audience recognized that he hadn't said all worthy male members. He said all worthy members got the priesthood. I thought, wow, I missed something. I mean, I was really excited in 78, and he talked about the, you know, the tears and the prayers and the thanks, and I think of how much more joy we will have if we have the same kind of revelation for all worthy members. It is my dream that someday men and women might sit at tables together and collectively work towards solving the problems of society and the world. That good ideas might be valued and nurtured and implemented, whether those ideas come from men or from women. That someday girls and boys may stand together as deacons, teachers, and priests to pass the sacrament. The 12-year-old girls and their parents might beam with pride at the girls' first Sunday of service in passing the sacrament. That female missionaries might baptize the people that they have lovingly worked with in conversion. And I regret that the change has not come early enough for me or for my daughters, but I hope for a brighter future and for our posterity. Carolyn Heilbrunn said, "Ideas move fast when their time has come. It is my hope and my prayer that the time is now and that the idea of priesthood for women may move quickly, that we may plant the seed." And again, with the attitude that if the right questions are asked, perhaps the revelation would come, not with a negative or attacking attitude. And that I really appreciate that from both. Anyway, thank you for your time, and I leave these thoughts with you.
Amen. I would just like to thank you. I, like probably many of you, sort of sat here and sort of basked in your words. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes for questions. Why don't you come up here to the front and just ask them at your convenience.
Several years ago, Scott and I were in Brazil together as missionaries, and I think perhaps our feeling about this issue may be sensitized by the fact that in Brazil, when we were there, of course, this was a long time before the revelation, and there was one crisis after another, and personal teachings with members, members who had been in the church for 5 or 10 years, courage to do genealogy, and suddenly they find out, bang, grandma or great-grandfather was a black, and zap, no more priesthood. Or the young teenage girl that falls in love with a handsome teenage boy, should she fall in love with him? Maybe he has black ancestry, and so forth and so on. There was a very interesting article in Dialogue some 8 or 10 years ago about the correlation between the historical event of the temple being dedicated in São Paulo, Brazil, and the revelation on the priesthood. It would have been very difficult to have a functioning temple in Brazil without universal male priesthood. Very few people would have been really able to go, or it would have been almost an empty temple, so to speak. Anyway, now, of course, the gospel is growing enormously in Brazil. When Scott and I were there, just the two of us and about 100 other missionaries took care of the whole country. Now they have something like 16 or 17 missions to cover the country. Anyway, my point is this. Revelation in the post-charismatic period of the church tends to come when the church bumps against a brick wall. Think of the discussions of the Manifesto in 1890. In the crunch of the church being literally destroyed as an institution by the federal government because of the practice of polygamy. And my understanding with this article and my own personal belief that the coming of the revelation about the priesthood to all adult males or all worthy males came in the crunch of what was happening in Brazil. There would be an empty temple. It was only 14 years after the civil rights legislation of 1964 in the United States. There's often a lag. We would like to believe that the prophetic church would be avant-garde. We would be ahead. we would have the insight. I could spend a lot of time on that subject. But anyway, can any of the panelists see a crunch that might be coming in the immediate future, which would suggest the viability or the advisability of a revelation for priesthood to women as well as men? If in view of this hypothesis that I'm suggesting, that often revelation comes in the context of a collision that dictates the necessity of the revelation or of a change. I'd like to see it happening otherwise. I'd like to see it avant-garde, so to speak. But anyway, I just wondered, in view of this hypothesis, if anyone has any comments on... By the way, I was very impressed at all three presentations. Scott was very organized, appreciated the literary allegories in Jody's presentation and the personal comments that came from the third participant. I thought these were all very stimulating and very much to the point.
I think the crunch is the very growth of the church. This church is growing into areas that have maternal societies now. And we cannot deny societies that have gone back for centuries. But the bigger crunch is that half the population is recognizing that no one can tell them any longer that they aren't worthy. And that crunch is not a crunch. It's an atomic bomb. So I don't think we can adequately describe the comparison, because I'm not trying to diminish the experience of the blacks and the priesthood, but this involves every race of women, and it's much greater than the civil rights aspect of it, because it's just a much greater segment of the society.
I think it's a soft crunch. We probably don't have anything to do about it. It's probably happening completely outside of our control, but it's happening. My friend that says what we need is 3,000 women withdrawing participation with names on lists and tithing, that would do it. I doubt it. Okay, men, same thing. What is it that moves? What is it that touches us? How can we help? How can we contribute to the touching we're doing? Let's touch a lot. It's a soft crunch.
I had two thoughts. One is that we're losing more young women now in greater numbers than we ever have in the past, and that's never been a population that we had to worry about in the past. So that's the soft crunch also, because the church is concerned about that. There are demographic studies being done in 98 places. I'm one of the data collectors for the study, and it's quite fascinating that they're doing a long-term study on teens and their attitude development and spiritual and social. It's a fascinating study. I hope we get the results published so we can all see them, but but I'm sure they will in some format. The crunch that I had hoped would come, and this is cynical, and it's something I've never said before on out loud, except in small groups, but my personal opinion was that if ERA had passed, that would have been the crunch, because I think it would have been impossible to hold tax-exempt status properties and buildings without allowing women the ordination. That's a personal conclusion that I drew when I was a Mormon for ERA, living in Illinois, when we were being told by our church leaders that the church was not fighting against ERA, and yet I was witnessing Relief Society announcements that we should meet at the chapel in order to drive to Springfield to be concerned citizens. That was a crunch that I had hoped would come. It didn't. The church is real effective and as a political power. And I don't know if that strong of a crunch will ever come again. It's very easy to distinguish between men and women as opposed to blacks and whites in Brazil, usually. The question is about violence. I hate violence, but what is your question? I'm sorry. There's another good point. Okay, a contribution from Helen Meeks. Another possible crunch in answer to the previous question is the escalation of violence, and perhaps that is a strong enough, scary enough phenomenon that we do need to address it. Suppose the Catholics do it first. The RLDS did it in 1984. We went to Nauvoo this summer, and it's interesting because the priesthood isn't given to all people. It's given as a calling. And so not all men, not all women have the priesthood in their RLDS church. But if Catholics did it first, I don't know, have we been followed? I don't know. I'm sorry. Next question.
The RLDS is half the size it was before.